able to erase this year's losses on Friday, and the NASDAQ closed at the highest point in 15 years. Welcome back, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek. It's just great to be back with you. We've got another GoldSeek.com episode lined up this weekend with top guests and the market headlines. Well, what a difference 1 week can make in these markets. Thanks in no small part to dovish comments from the FOMC meeting report. Investors decided maybe our officials won't pull the trigger after all on their interest rate howitzers, at least not this summer. That was music to the ears of precious metals and equities investors, in particular for small cap equities, which benefit most as large cap profits evaporate on dollar strength. In this week's show, a soon-to-be movie star joins us. Martin Armstrong is the subject of The Forecaster, a documentary taking Europe by storm, scheduled to debut this week on the West Coast and then in a fortnight in New York City. We cover some of the documentary's controversial topics. Our guest compares the economic carnage in the EU to the fallout in our Detroit, a once vibrant showcase of capitalism. The U.S. dollar may have much further to go thanks to deflation, and then gold is the ultimate hedge against government risk. The bull market will resume as investors lose faith in their governments. He thinks that could happen as soon as October of this year. And don't worry so much about higher interest rates. Martin Armstrong says the rates will go higher eventually and well into 2017, but it'll have little impact on the stock market. His models call for 23,000 Dow, which is just a few thousand points away, with an outside chance of 35,000 to 40,000 if retail investors re-enter the market, just like we saw back in the year 2000. Then Louis Navalier, a favorite of the show, joins us. His stock portfolios continue to top the Wall Street Journal's profitability charts for 2014 and 15. He's watching negative retail sales. He's concerned that deflation is a big problem for the Fed and global central bankers who have little in their arsenals to defend against that economic malady. And he shares one of his favorite stock picks with us. He likes gold and platinum allocations in 2015. Robert Ian, with his latest must-hear editorial, wraps up the show. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market recap. Sunny skies return to the precious metals markets this week on dovish comments from the FOMC, which wrapped up a meeting and sent out a report on Wednesday of this week. The news sent the dollar tumbling from 12-year record highs, which also sent silver into the stratosphere by about 8%. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold added about $26, ending at $1,184 an ounce, just shy of $1,200. Silver picked up $1.24, just shy of $17, while the XAU Gold and Silver Equities Index added 3%, finishing at 65, and West Texas Intermediate Crude Oil added $1.50, rebounding from the lowest lows in years, but showing strong signs of accumulation at $46.57 a barrel in the weekly chart. The top story driving the markets this week stemmed from the FOMC meeting. Fed officials revealed their latest rate guidance this week, and they were a bit more dovish than anticipated. Federal Reserve Chair Dr. Janet Yellen noted that the U.S. Central Bank was in no hurry to raise rates. Lower inflation and output expectations were a big plus for the precious metals. Gold blasted higher, erasing all of this year's losses in a single week, while the greenback plunged, as I mentioned, from a multi-decade high. The new Fed chair led many market watchers to comment that the anticipated June rate hike could be postponed until later in the year or even next year. Meanwhile, the Greek drama continued as economists wonder whether the peninsula nation of antiquity will remain part of the EU. Euro ministers and related parties are expressing some doubts as to their ability to strike an amicable solution between the Greek officials and their concerned debtors. However, the euro rally this week suggests that at least for the time being, the storm has paused. Elsewhere in gold-related news, shares of Yamana Gold, AUY, flew higher nearly 6% on Friday to $4 amid a strong rally in the mining sector stocks. Yamana Gold was upgraded to overweight from neutral by HSBC analysts on news of valuation prospects and manageable debt. Plus, news of a dollar plunge helped the sector precious metals bottom line. Well, as noted in the last report, accumulation of the XAU Gold and Silver Shares Index was a solid indication of the rally that unfolded this week. Still, the onus remains fully on the shoulders of the bulls. The U.S. dollar has entered what appears to be the beginning of a multi-year bull market, which must be monitored closely by gold aficionados. So for next week's stock candidates and all of the forecasts, please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility was virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange this week on favorable comments from the FOMC report. On Friday, the Dow Jones Industrials finished higher by 378 points, closing above that psychologically significant 18,000 level at 18,127, about a 2% gain for the week. The S&P 500 finished at 2108, 55 points higher, more than 2.5%, and the NASDAQ picked up 155, finishing at 5026, over 3%. Just one more week like this, and the 15-year peak posted in 2000 will be surpassed. And that was exactly 51.32 and 52 cents on March 10th of 2000. Just over 15 years since that peak. Well, the Russell 2000 also hit a new record, up 11.5 points, about 1%, finishing at 1266. The small cap stocks, of course, are outperforming their larger cousins as the strong dollar is eroding the competitiveness of multinationals and their exports. Bottom line on Wall Street, our favorite 7-indicator sentiment index, which told us that the selling was over last week and a rally was likely, well, it switched from fearful to neutral this week, and this is a positive because it means investors aren't convinced the rally is solid, so we could see further gains next week. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with our two big guests, Martin Armstrong and Louis Navalier. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE.
Own shares, nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Louis Navalier runs Navalier & Associates. He's also editor of four leading stock advisory newsletters. Welcome back, Louis Navalier.
It's good to be here.
Great to have you back. And you know, last Friday, we had a bullish jobs report. U.S. dollar blasted to a 12-year high against the euro, at least. It's making records in terms of almost every other competing global currency. Seems to have caught a lot of investors off guard. I wonder if you could tell us just what's going on here.
Yeah, this is the big story. We've been calling since January for a seismic shift, and it's clearly underway. What the seismic shift is how the strong dollar is essentially destroying corporate profits for the multinationals in the S&P 500, and it's worse as you get to the bigger ones. 70% of the top 50 stocks in the S&P are going to have negative sales and or earnings in April. And one of the ones I thought was going to have more positive results, Intel warned and lowered their guidance. The party's over if you want sales and earnings. The strength in the market is in domestic stocks. There are large-cap domestic stocks like Kroger and Lowe's and Southwest Airlines. Dollar Tree, would be an example. But I'll tell you, it's getting really, really hard out there. And we saw this in 2000. Essentially, the tail end of the S&P is going to do better than the top end. Domestic are going to do better multinational. And this is going to last a long time. MarketWatch had a more detailed article on this that predicted that the S&P 500's earnings will be down every single quarter this year, and forecasted that the fourth quarter earnings are going to be down over 20%. Now, that's not going to come out until January of 2016, but that's pretty ominous. And everybody's shocked by the speed of which this has happened. The dollar has appreciated 12% against the euro just this year, and it's up about 17% against from its low point last year.
Earnings tend to be such an important, vital component to a bullish market, at least for equities, throughout the whole 6 or 7 year advance. Is there a peak here? Will we see 5,100 on the NASDAQ again?
We're going to go up, and I'm going to tell you why we're going to go up. Here's essentially why. The market yields more than the bank. So if you're a yield-hungry investor, you have to go to the market. But whether you're buying the dividend stocks or the growth stocks, you just can't buy the whole market now. It's gotten very narrow. Our forecast is for a silver lining critical path to emerge. You know, I was up nicely in January when the market was down. All my funds showed up in the Wall Street Journal for being top. Then February was even stronger, okay? I've had, there was a down day the other day this week. I was up, okay? That's a good sign. As long as I've got 10 to 15% of the market to buy, I'm okay. But the strong dollar's in a number. And it's also causing massive deflation, and this is affecting Fed policy. We've just had 3 months in a row of horrific retail sales. And the stock markets like inflation, and economic statistics like inflation. And now we have deflation. Retail sales can't go up even if we're out spending more money because prices are falling. So we've already seen what that's done to retail sales. This is going to affect Fed policy. The Fed cannot raise rates in this environment. If they did, they're just going to make the dollar stronger and raise the deflation risk. So this is ominous. If you want to know what I'm worried about deflation.
You're not as concerned then about disinflation. To me, this sounds more disinflationary amid rampant global inflation. The moniker deflation, it kind of conjures up images, doesn't it, of the 1930s, you know, the Depression. You don't see something like that on the horizon, do you?
We are in new territory. We're not used to this. We're in an environment where 19% of the government debt worldwide has a negative yield. And if I lived in Europe with a crummy currency and negative yield at the bank, I have put my money elsewhere. A lot of Europeans are putting their money in America, getting higher yields over here, prospering for our currency tailwind. Others are buying gold. You know, the criticism of gold, it never had yield. Well, guess what? No yield is better than negative yield. And if you look at gold priced in euros, it's up.
In terms of rubles, it's the investment of the year.
Mr. Putin, he puts over half a billion in gold every month. You know, he did a number on his currency. Last I looked, it fell 54%.
Exactly right. And, you know, that's certainly tied directly to the crude oil plunge. Another story, Labor Department reported that there was quite a bit of jobs created, well above the estimates. And this tends to make some investors a little nervous because they're afraid the Fed's going to raise rates.
I work for the Fed. We had a staff economist named Janet Yellen there. She's got a more important role now. She's a labor economist. If someone goes out and gets 2 temp jobs, they get counted twice. This isn't me. This is the Fed. The Fed noted in 2013 that the payroll survey was growing faster than the broader household survey. And there was double accounting in the numbers. That's why they removed the unemployment target. Now, there's less double accounting now, but clearly most of the jobs being created are temp. There's been downward revisions here recently. The January jobs figure was revised down. I expect February revised down. The ADP folks, which do payroll processing, can't find the job growth. The Department of Labor can. Gallup can't find it either. It's almost like there might be an election coming up. I can't imagine why the numbers got so good all of a sudden, but there are seasonal distortions as well. The market reacts. They don't think. They don't read the second line. If you look in the details, it's not good. We have had 2 months of wage growth, and Janet Yellen doesn't want to raise rates so we get wage growth. Well, 3 cents in February isn't growth, okay? It's just not. And it was down in December, so if you average it out, there really isn't wage growth. It's still too many temp jobs. There's seasonal distortion. So the Fed's not going to raise rates as far as I'm concerned. And that's not me. That's the head of the Boston Fed, the Chicago Fed, the Minneapolis Fed. They don't want to raise rates at all this year. It would be irresponsible for them to raise rates. All they're going to do is make the dollar stronger, create more deflation risk, and that destroys our economy.
From the last Fed meeting minutes, there was some dissent among the doves.
Well, the main thing is the biggest dissent was coming from Dallas and Philadelphia, and those Fed presidents have retired. So the new opposition is emerging from Cleveland, but she hasn't voted against the Fed yet. So that's that.
You know, certainly then if you expect this amazing bull market to continue, and it certainly caught many people off guard, so there's probably still money waiting on the sidelines. There'll be a sector rotation all throughout the remaining rally, and it will be critical to make sure that you have focused on the right sectors and not the laggards. So maybe you could give folks an idea of what you see as, you know, the stronger places to park cash.
Clearly, it's in consumer discretionary. Consumer staples, and it's not in energy. So I do think that we have some strength for a change. So that's very encouraging. Now, when I dig into the raw fundamentals, I can't find as many consumer stocks as I want. But I can tell you, Lowe's is one of my favorite. There's been a lot of damage in the Northeast this year. I can tell you Dollar Tree showed up on our radar, so did a limited brand, VF Corp. I have some retail stocks.
Now let's turn over to China, starting to see what looks like some economic growth. And, of course, that could bode well for the rest of the world. What do you think about China's prospects? That HSBC survey looked more positive and their PMI is stronger. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, HSBC is always more negative than the official survey until recently. So that shows the private sector in China is doing well. You know, I spent a long time on a plane with one of the architects in China. He has to build big walls around the luxury homes over there because of the corruption crackdown. And there's some flight out of China, you know, mostly to America. They're bringing in their capital and all that stuff. I think China's going to be fine. India is now outpacing them in GDP growth. You know, the folks in India spend a lot of money on food and energy, and all of a sudden they have a more disposable income for a change. But you know, I still expect China to grow at a healthy pace, but, you know, we'll see if they make their 7% target right now. But the rest of the world is growing. There was a report that came out the other day from BeSpokes that were talking about how they expect China and India to lead. Normally when you get a commodity prices dropping, it does feel boom in emerging markets because people just have more money left over.
Well, any positive comments then for the precious metals listeners, aficionados in the audience? It's been a tough 3 years. Do you see any positives on the horizon, or will the dollar rally crush any remaining hopes?
Gold, I believe, was the best performing commodity in 2014. Obviously, a lot of central banks are still buying gold. Obviously, there's a lot of uncertainty in the world with these negative yields, the earnings for the S&P. I can find earnings, but the whole market's not going to have it. So I think gold deserves a decent allocation because that's where people are going to run when they lose, when they get insecure. And it just, you know, sometimes the markets have to go down 2 or 3 weeks before gold rallies. I also like platinum very much, a very good industrial metal, mostly sourced from South Africa and Russia. I think, you know, it's very strong industrial demand. So I'm very comfortable with both those. Silver is just much more volatile than gold, of course. So I think it's going to be okay. I mean, I think I would up the allocation a bit because the uncertainty has gotten upped. The other thing that's interesting is normally the third and fourth year of presidential election term is very good for the market. We got all these new candidates running around. You can see what the mainstream media is doing to Hillary Clinton lately. So there's some unpredictability going on out there. You know, if somebody told me that, you know, the mainstream media that was obviously very kind to, I think Americans are just not as happy as they want to be, and they're obviously looking for leadership. And I think they're going to be very disappointed how this deflation is really taking a toll on our economic growth and the hope for prosperity moving forward. So I think gold definitely, and a little bit to degree platinum, deserves a higher allocation. So say somebody had 6%, maybe they want to boost it to 8.
Any other topicality on your radar screen?
No, I still don't think they're going to raise rates this year. I think the big wild card we have is what are we going to do with all the oil? Obviously, we have the highest inventory in 80 years. I've seen inventories rise for 9 straight weeks. We still have excess diesel and gas inventories. Normally in the springtime, demand goes up and prices go up. But this is interesting where we're at right now. I mean, this is quite fascinating. There's been all these articles, we're going to run out of storage and places to put it come April. This is more than a seismic shift. I think oil will go higher as demand goes up, but I don't know if the high is going to be 62, 65, 68. We have the situation in Libya where, you know, the 11 major wells they have are not secure anymore by the security forces. Their production's a third of what it once was. Iraq's still producing more oil because they've got to deal with the Kurds, even though the wells around Tikrit are on fire. You know, there could be some interesting developments out there, but I think by and large, lower commodity prices are going to cause other areas to grow, and that's where we got to put the money. And it's just unfortunate a lot of the currency is just doing a big number on America. Very, very hard for us to really grow fast when our dollar is hurting our competitiveness and hurting our exports, and actually is going to hurt GDP growth. These are all reasons the Fed should not raise rates, and I think our dollar remains strong as long as our rates are higher than the rest of the world. So market forces are going to force rates lower. That's going to fuel more buybacks, but in the meantime, it's still an interesting place to be. This market has gotten very narrow very quickly. Whether I'm doing dividend management or growth management, I literally only got to be in the top 15%.
Interesting. So I guess the bottom line here is the dollar as high as it is, of course, it makes exports considerably less competitive around the world. So this would kind of tie the Fed's hands, because if they raise rates, that just makes dollar-denominated assets, bonds, and related treasuries all the more appealing to global investors, which would just push the dollar and the greenback even higher, kind of a self-fulfilling negative.
That's correct. And all economists, liberal, conservative, are all trained not to have deflation. So this is a new chapter for America, and they have deflation in Japan, they have deflation in Europe, you can see they're trying to just pump money to get rid of it. We turned off our pumps, so we're attracting a lot of capital to our rates collapse. If our GDP slows, maybe we'll slow down a bit. But I can tell you, this is a new world we're in, and now it's hurting corporate profits, so that's just another reason to up the gold allocation and platinum allocation.
Please tell folks more about the services you provide and any other contact information you'd like to share today.
The good thing about us is our research is online free. On Navalier.com, the management company, we have a free dividend grader, a free stock grader, a free ETF grader. On our newsletter site, we just have the free stock grader. But that's NavalierGrowth.com. Navalier.com is the management company. We like people to go see how we grade stocks and see how we rank. You can take our newsletter or paid subscribers if you would like me to pick the stocks for you. I personally seed mutual funds and run around and grow them. Obviously, I got a very good fund this year. It's been the top decile and attracting a lot of capital. So, yeah, we have a lot of good things for investors, but in the end, we'd like them to check out our online database. It's free, and then we'll figure out how we can best serve people.
Louis Navalier, we appreciate your time today.
Thank you. Take care now.
Martin Armstrong created the Economic Confidence Model. He's author of The Greatest Bull Market in History and founder of Princeton Economics. There's also a big movie that's been made about him recently called The Forecaster. This is his debut appearance on Gold Seek. Welcome, Martin Armstrong.
Thank you for inviting me.
Why don't we just start off today with your movie? This is an interesting documentary called The Forecaster, and I wonder if you could tell us how it came about, you know, maybe how the producers contacted you, a synopsis.
Well, it's all basically done, funded by European groups, including TV, et cetera, over there. So I think largely we have a problem in the United States, and I think everybody's beginning to recognize it with, you know, mainstream media, how they try to really suppress a lot of things. Like Snowden, for example. If he had shown up at the New York Times and said, look, here are all the documents I took from the NSA, they would have said, gee, would you like a cup of coffee? While they, you know, stalled them waiting for the NSA to come get them, you know. Because honestly, I can tell you, I speak to people on Capitol Hill. And 2 years before Snowden, they were telling me nonchalantly over the phone, be careful what you say and what you put in emails to us. And I said, what? And they said, yeah, NSA's taking all our stuff. I said, your stuff too? And they said, yeah. So it wasn't like it was in some dark off room, you know, I got something really secret to tell you. So if they're telling me that openly on the phone, that meant every journalist in Washington, D.C. knew too. And that's why Snowden had to go to London, to The Guardian. And then the U.S. press comes out and goes, oh, my God, look at that. You know, gee, isn't that amazing? We never heard of this, you know. And it's the same, you know, so honestly, that's what I ended up having to do as well.
Most of the relevant news comes from The Telegraph, or like you said, The Guardian. I mean, it's overseas today.
Yes, United States is just, you have its own largely the corporate media. And, you know, they're going to get a phone call. And I can tell you, I knew the executive, the number two guy at New York Post. And he explained it to me, you know, and he said, listen, they pick up the phone and they say, we have a favor. And if you do not do what they tell you to do, he says, then they come after you personally for taxes or this, that, the other thing. I mean, they're now down in Australia. There's a scandal going on. The same thing. They're going after the journalists for anybody that's leaking information to them. You know, government is just desperate to hold a line, and they, you know, prefer not to get anything out. So this movie is largely, it's sold out everywhere overseas. And in fact, I didn't even think it was going to get into the United States. And we had to tell people, listen, I'm sorry, you know, it's not going to be shown here. You know, they won't let it in. And all of a sudden, the company stood up and said, nope, we're going to do it. So it's actually debuting in L.A., I think the 27th, the end of this week, and then in New York the first week of April. But overseas, they've largely called it a political thriller. It's going into the details of you wouldn't believe. I mean, they're actually trying to take over Russia, and there's you hear things. You know, a part of what's not in the movie, I would say, is that there was they had charged Bank of New York, which is primarily a custodian bank. And it's not one of the big money center type banks. They charged it with money laundering, the largest money laundering case in history, $7 billion. They actually steered this wire through Bank of New York. And then Republic National Bank, which is now HSBC, immediately runs to the government and says, oh, we think Bank of New York was involved in money laundering. So this is part of the movie. The bank, U.S. government runs in. It was them trying to take over Russia. And at the end of the day, what's not in the movie is that, you know, Bank of New York, you know, the two brokers finally plead guilty, no jail time, 6 months, that's it, go home. And the judge says, oh, well, okay, fine. Well, who was this money, you know, this money laundering for? And they just said, oh, a Russian businessman. Oh, okay, fine. Thank you very much. You don't even ask the name. And it's ridiculous. I mean, who could pay $7 billion as a ransom? And if somebody could pay that much, you would have heard it in the news that he was kidnapped, you know? New York is just absolutely, I mean, whatever comes out of there.
You know, it's not all that fantastic, though, for those of us who have read Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. And then, of course, Frank Portnoy's Fiasco. Kind of see the writing on the wall.
All I do know is that it will be in the United States starting this week. Where it goes from there, I am not sure. I did have a meeting with somebody from Hollywood who I won't mention his name, but he said to me, he says, this is a fantastic movie. He says, you know, we got problems. I said, what's the problem? He says, well, you know, Hollywood, we kind of have this self-censorship. I said, what is that? And he says, well, you know, if it's going to piss off somebody, we got to, you know, really think twice about it. So I guess ever since the McCarthy days, they eventually it will probably be on DVD, et cetera. I do know it will be shown on all. It goes to the network TVs in Europe, outside the United States, I think by October. See, you have a different attitude. I mean, here in the United States, those that would question what's going on in government are still in the minority. you know, and you kind of see with the split going on in the Republican Party. You know, I mean, I think even Glenn Beck just came out and he says, that's it, I'm no longer a Republican, I give up. So you see a lot of discontent. And I've worked with governments around the world for 30 years, and I can tell you there is absolutely no difference between a Republican and a Democrat. They both know what buttons to push. They get everybody riled up over the social issues. When it comes to economics, they're the same. You have a real rift developing because you have financial and fiscal conservatives in the Republican Party. And Bonner has just basically cut deals with the Democrats to circumvent them. His own party. He hired people to deliberately try to defeat anybody from the Tea Party. Anybody that supported Ron Paul, he had him removed from any chairmanship of any committee. He's pretty bad, you know. And you know, ironically, the conservative Democrats Republicans wanted to overthrow him. The Democrats are supporting them.
Jump into the debt issues that are plaguing the EU. You've compared this to the Detroit bankruptcy. And that was a city that was the hallmark of capitalistic success, tied in with deflation we're seeing around the world. And we're seeing more countries drop rates into negative territory. We haven't really faced anything like this since maybe the Great Depression. Give us an idea of what you see happening, please.
Well, a couple different aspects to this. One is that, honestly, I can tell you, the commission that formed the euro came to us initially, sat down, said, this is how it has to be designed. You have to, you know, consolidate all the debts, etc. They went through, and what they told me personally was that they didn't think they had the votes to get a consolidated debt, but they just wanted to get the currency in first. And then they would make that phase two. Well, then those people leave. I mean, you can find it on the internet. I published, you know, this thing is going to collapse. And back in 1996, 97, you know, this is a design. It's just impossible to work. And so that first, you know, people, they leave. And then you have other people come in, and they're like, well, what's phase two? Never heard of it. And so they defend the euro at the cost of absolutely everything, because they have created tens of thousands of jobs in Brussels, and they're only defending their own self-interest. That's it. The reason the euro could never survive is you take a big insurance company or something, life company, let's say they got $1 trillion, and they just want to be conservative and park it and what they think is safe government debt. Can you buy euro debt? No. It's at the state level. You end up having to say, okay, fine, well, let me look at Spain, let me look at this. You have to buy each one individually. They all have different credit ratings. And so there's no one, you know, place to park your money. And it would be the equivalent as if the banks in the United States used state debt to back them for reserves. Then it depends, you know, and what state they have. Each one's different. So this is why the euro could never, you know, really displace the dollar. And by default, the dollar just keeps going up and up and up because there's no other place to park money. You have to understand it from that big, you know, dollar perspective. And so Europe is a total basket case. The average German now pays more than 50% in taxes. The German municipal governments are all basically more than 50% of those are in bankruptcy, and the government's proposing to put on a 15% surcharge tax to bail out the municipals. The problem with governments, and this is honestly globally, because I've met with them in Europe, here, wherever, they haven't funded a lot of this stuff. And people have heard, you know, unfunded liabilities, et cetera. But why haven't they? Because basically they just have always looked at this as that, well, we have the great unwashed, and they'll always be there. So why should they put money away? Because, you know, you're always going to have more and more kids, and therefore, you know, we can just grab, you know, whatever we need when we need it. They haven't funded this stuff. And then what happens at this point is very simple, is that you have the, let's say you take a municipal like Detroit. Detroit went down. Why? Because its budgets, right, what was being spent, you know, exceeded 50% was going to pensions. All right, so you're no longer even funding the current administration. All right, so you take a look at it this way. You take a small, you know, municipality. It has 20 police. 10 retire. Now you still got to pay the 10 because you didn't put the money away to begin with. And now you have to hire 10 more. So the cost of government has been rising exponentially. And let's face it, you know, it's great propaganda. They say, oh, the 1%, the rich, the rich, the rich. What happens? Everybody cheers, yeah, yeah, go get them. They just take the money and put it in their pocket. It doesn't lower anybody else's taxes ever. I saw it in Australia. They had a great campaign for the luxury tax. We're going to tax their Ferraris, their fur coats, and their French wines. Everybody cheered. Yeah, go get them. Okay, they passed the tax. What was in it? All electrical products. I mean, just these people, you know, honestly, if they had a bubble gum machine and they sold all the bubble gum and they spent all the money that came in, oh, gee, I got to refill it. What do I do? Oh, go steal some more bubble gum, fill it up again. That's it. You know, these people have no concept of how to run anything. And, you know, nearly 40% are lawyers. You do not have the person actually, or where are the scientists, the different fields, people having experience in different things. You know, all we have are lawyers. A lawyer knows how to write a law. He knows nothing about economics. He knows nothing about managing anything. And that's the problem.
If it all is geared towards one profession, the pendulum is going to swing way too far to one side.
Why do you think we don't get legal reform or anything else? All right, why is the cost of health care here in the United States so astronomically high? It's largely because of all the lawsuits in unlimited amounts. You go to Australia, other countries, all right, fine. If you get injured and you lose a left arm or something, there's a price for it. It's already set. Here it's like, oh, well, you know, he would have been, you know, Michelangelo, and he should get $150 million, and then the lawyer takes 60%.
Back, though, to the threat of deflation, cracks in the foundation in the United States. Now, do you see anything like Europe happening here once the dollar rally starts to fade?
The dollar actually has to rally a lot more first. That's capital coming here. The mistake that a lot of people do make with currency is they tend to think, they judge it like stock. So the dollar is going up, that means it's bullish. No, it doesn't. It actually makes the economy worse. Because the higher it goes, it reduces the exports, et cetera, et cetera. So that is really deflationary. It's not inflationary. So actually, a stronger dollar is actually what brings down the economy, all right? And if you just do a correlation, it's very interesting. The historical high for the dollar was during the Great Depression, you know, not at the peak. At the peak, it's on the opposite side of assets. So when the dollar is rising, assets are going down. And you see gold going down, a lot of things have been going down, commodities in general. All right, when did gold rise? It rose basically when our economic confidence model went down. It doesn't rise because of inflation. It rises when? It's clear when people lose confidence in government. It's a hedge against government. Then people panic because you don't know who's going to survive. That's why gold is done well during wars, because you're not then betting on who's going to win. So it's kind of like the alternative, you know, the third party type thing. And you have to understand that that's what, you know, is a lot of people misrepresented that it's, oh, it's a hedge against inflation. They sell it that way. It's not true. I mean, if you do a correlation with gold and against, you know, even 1982 dollars, we've published charts, you know, you see, it didn't take out the 1980 high. That adjusted for inflation, it's about $2,300 right now. So when it goes through these things and makes big, you know, spikes, it's when the confidence in government collapses.
Do you see a moment in the future where folks lose confidence?
I think that's largely coming after October, you know, and then we'll be back to about a four-year period of really declining confidence in government, not just here, but everywhere. Because everyone knows that there's something wrong. They can't maybe put their finger on it, but, and, you know, there's a lot of, I think that a lot of people get confused, and because there's too many pretend analysts out there that just focus on one thing. And that's not the way the world works. I mean, we've got offices overseas, and everybody is going to respond according to their own currency. All right. If I say, gee, you should be investing in Mexico, but the Mexican peso is going to fall by 50% and the stock market will rise by 25%, you didn't make any money. A Mexican did, but you didn't. That's very, very critical. Right now, the Europeans have been making a lot of money in the U.S. assets, real estate, stock markets. You don't see it. Whatever you see as far as the decline in the euro, 30%, that is what U.S. assets rose in value to them. But you didn't see the 30%. So, it you know, currency is very important to understand. And our definition of a bull market is when something is rising in terms of all currencies. Then now everybody's buying it and you're getting a capital concentration. That won't take place because we have a lot of people, as far as government is concerned, they're very skeptical. People are starting to question what's going on here. We have a fight in the Republican Party, and you'll see a rise in third-party activity for 2016 that we haven't seen since probably Teddy Roosevelt. But it's just time. That's when gold would respond. It's not going to respond at this point in the game. There's no reason to. You know, people are like, you know, all right, fine. You know, stock market's doing okay. I'm getting my check right now. So only when that sentiment of everybody changes, not just, you know, the small people that follow stuff, when you start changing, that's when you're going to see stuff like that move.
You mentioned the stock market, and for about 6 years now, we've entered one of the most protracted bull markets in American history, you know, in the Dow's 117-year history. But there's been nothing but naysayers the whole way, and as you mentioned, these pretendant analysts. You've got a pretty good, solid track record with using your cycles method. You seem to be pointing towards the latter part of this year. Is that still, you know, in the cards?
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, you've got everyone's saying, "Oh, stocks are overpriced. You got a crash." They're looking at it purely through American eyes, and I'll tell you why they're also wrong. Look at the rest of the statistics. You've got retail participation practically at historic lows, liquidity at like 50%. So why is the stock market up? It's because of what we're talking about. You have people that are smart money is very concerned about defaults by governments, and that's unilaterally across the board in Europe. Why are the bunds, the German bonds, going up, and they're like 130-some basis points, you know, beyond the U.S.? It's because everybody's betting in Europe that the euro is going to fail. So they've been selling all the other bonds, buying the German. Why? Because they assume that once the euro fails, they'll get Deutsche Marks. That's the big bet over there. So you just had, you know, the opening of the ECB in Frankfurt. They turned Frankfurt into a war zone.
Yeah, but, you know, you talk about a failing euro. I mean, this would be an epic event worldwide. Is everybody going to be holding, as you say, German bonds and American dollars? What about the yuan?
Pretty much. I mean, China's got its own problems. Japan is kind of still pretty much a basket case. It's not going to – people keep thinking, oh, they got the highest GDP, debt, et cetera. But the government, effectively, the central bank owns 70% of its debt. They have extreme currency control, so nobody can really issue debt in yen. So it's not really a reserve currency. Europe will go first because it's largely – such civil unrest rising everywhere. They've been threatening Greece with practically nuclear weapons, you know, and all they're doing is driving it closer to Russia. And at the end of the day, there is no real victory here. We're looking at largely what I call the collapse of socialism. This is like the second shoe falling. The first one was in 1989 when communism fell, okay? But we are still Marxists, and everything we do is all based upon Marx. People don't realize it, but, I mean, Marx's theory was government has a role, and it can manipulate society and force what it wants. All right, before then, what did we have? Laissez-faire. All right, so even Keynes, every economist, you know, has followed Marx. If you really, you know, put a couple of drinks in them, they'll go, oh, yeah, that's maybe. But they don't want to admit that they're Marxists, but they are.
Assuming you're not in the Austrian school, like so many of us here in the gold crowd who believe, as you say, hands off, please.
Right, well, that's I mean, you're always going to have the laissez-faire. You know, but I'm talking about the bulk of the people who are in control. All right, they're Marxists. It is something that government wants to hear. All right, they want to be able to feel powerful. And I mean, I'll give you an example because I've really worked with governments for a long time, and I can tell you the way it works. It's let's say you're at the bottom of a hill in San Francisco. I walk up to you and I hold out my hand and I say, I just saved your life. What's it worth to you? And you're going to look at me like, yeah. And I say, how'd you do that? Well, see that car at the top of the hill? It started to roll. I jumped in the car. I put on the brake. It would have killed you, but I stopped it. Are you going to believe me or not? This is the way politics is. You know, I can walk down there and say, listen, if we don't do this, 25 million people will die tomorrow. And go, yeah, but what if you're wrong? They would rather have the event happen than be put on these big, you know, investigative hearings. Oh, we're going to find out who it is. They love that. You know, a politician knows he cannot run for office saying, vote for me because I saved your job. How did you save my job? Because I vetoed this or whatever, you know. Yeah, well, I'm not sure I would have lost my job if he didn't.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the FOMC meeting this week. You know, they dropped the patient terminology where they were going to wait, Dr. Yellen and company there, the Fed governors, changing their language a little bit, but they really still have agreed there's not going to be a rate hike as soon as April, maybe June at the earliest on their benchmark lending rate. Give us an idea of whether or not you think folks are waiting on the sidelines to see what the Fed's going to do, or will it be a non-event?
The Fed's between a rock and a hard place. And
well, they've painted themselves into a corner here.
The reason they want to raise rates is to get out of that corner. They're being lobbied by the IMF and everybody else because you have a lot of these emerging markets that ended up issuing a lot of debt in denominated in dollars because the interest rate was cheap. So if the Fed starts raising rates, then you're going to start seeing sovereign defaults and all the BRICS and stuff. A clash between international policy objectives versus domestic. This is one of the things I'm saying. Eventually, we're going to have some sort of international reserve currency that can't be the dollar. Because, you know, the United States cannot then, the Fed is in a real difficult position because the stock market continues to rally up. They have to raise rates. If they don't, they're going to be criticized for creating the bubble. So this is, ironically, exactly the same position they found themselves in 1927. They lowered interest rates in the United States because they knew Europe was in trouble. And they were hoping to send the capital flows back to Europe under the theory, we'll lower rates here, the rates will be higher in Europe, so the money will go back there. It didn't. Looked at that and said, the Fed wouldn't have done this unless there really was a problem. So it came this way. Then the criticism of the Fed centered on that for domestic reasons. They said, oh, the Fed lowered rates and that is what created the bubble into 1929. Not true. But if you look at it, the Fed then raised rates from 3% to 6%. They doubled it, trying to stop the rally. All right. when interest rates decline, that's when a bear market happens. Just look at it, 2007, all right, look at Japan. You know, you had declining rates, the negative, basically. You have Europe going negative. This is not bullish. You know, again, it's people that do not understand the economy. Lowering rates like this, they think they're going to stimulate, cause people to borrow. They won't. They will not borrow unless they think they can make a profit with it. It's not the empirical level of rates. We've ran studies on all the interest rates going back a couple hundred years. The stock market has never peaked with the same level of interest rates twice. Why? Because if you think the stock market's going to double by next year, you'll pay 25%. If you think it's only going to go up 5%, you're not going to pay 3%. So it's the difference between expectation and the rate. It's not the empirical level of rates. That's why the stock market's never peaked with the same level twice. It's kind of like lightning that way. So the Fed will be forced to abandon international policy objectives and will have to raise rates. So we should see rates start to rise, and they're going to continue to rise probably into 17. And they'll get blamed internationally, but if they don't do that, they'll be blamed by everybody, every mainstream media, newspaper, and Congress, that you created the bubble, and the 1% have made so much money, and it's all your fault.
You're really taking the punch bowl, aren't you, away from the equities exchanges? Is that going to be the death knell for the stock market?
You know, I don't think you're going to see the stock market really take off. The retail will get back into it only when, you know, interest rates start to rise. And then we're in a situation which is opposite of 29. In 29, what was very interesting is, I mean, I read Galbraith in school, you know, the Great Crash, etc. You talk about propaganda. You can go online and get Herbert Hoover's memoirs. And I would suggest looking at chapter 1931. Every history book that has ever been written, including Galbraith, all right, there's no mention of a sovereign government default. None. It's all big corporations, this, that, the money people, blah, blah, blah. Okay. City of Detroit defaulted 1937 as well. All right. They finally made good 1963. All of Europe defaulted with the exception of Britain. They defaulted, called it a moratorium, then they came back. China defaulted. You can go buy their bonds on eBay. South America defaulted for the fourth time. That's what this Great Depression was about. All right, if you look at the chart carefully, you'll see the stock market fell a normal correction about 60%. All right, it started to rally out of 1930. Then what happens? All the foreign governments defaulted. Back then, instead of the mortgage-backed securities, the banks were selling foreign government bonds in small denominations. You had, you know, Mellon. During the, you know, at the crash said, well, gentlemen, buy bonds. You know, of course, Marilyn Monroe turned into blondes. But why? Because even the conservative people that bought bonds lost. There was nobody left standing. That is what makes a depression. The stock market will never make a depression. There's not enough money reserved in it. If you look at bonds, the amount of money in the bond market is at least 10 times that of what's in the stock market. If you undermine the bond market, now you've got serious stuff. Okay, you can take the stock market down 50%. That's not going to do anything. All right, economically, it's the bond market that's critical. And that's what we're dealing with here. All right, we're looking at a sovereign government default again. The last time was 1931. You can go back and you'll look, and it was 1842. You know, a lot of people, you know, they say, oh, Andrew Jackson, you know, he just got rid of the Bank of the United States. That was a terrible thing. Because then what happened when he ruined the central bank, then all of these wildcat banks popped up. Every bank in the country started issuing their own money. They all went bust. The states then had to issue bonds to try and bail out those banks, and then they defaulted. So you had state sovereign defaults in the 1840s. That created a major depression then. So it's the same scheme. It's like a Shakespeare's play, basically. It's the same plot that's played over and over and over again. It's just the actors change. That's part of government's solution, honestly, is because, again, they never take blame for anything. To them, they wouldn't have these problems if everybody paid. So what do they want to do? They want to eliminate paper money and move everything to digital. I mean, just look at it. I mean, you can look online. You can even buy. There were $10,000 bills they used to print in 1934. All right, the highest bill we have today is what, $100? All right, you can't even buy dinner with that. It's really, this has been a long plan, and they want to eliminate money as much as they possibly can. And in their view, if everybody, you know, if it's electronic money, then they get 110% of every tax.
Because there's no place left to hide if it's digital. Everything is accounted for.
Everything. I mean, and this is what FACT is about. They're destroying the world economy. Unbelievable.
As we wrap up here, Martin Armstrong, I wonder if you could tell folks where you're parking your hard-earned dineros. If you had to crack open the piggy bank right now, where would you put those funds, please?
Right now, basically, cash is king.
So you're expecting more deflation, then?
Still, yeah, we're still in the deflationary mode. I would really kind of look at metals as a hedge type thing, but you're probably looking more in the fall. And you have to understand what's going to make them go up, all right? And usually when there's a turn at the bottom, everybody's puking it out, and nobody is like, never buy that again, all right? And the same thing at the top, you're getting the opposite. Oh, you better hurry up and buy because you're going to double your money by next week. So they're extremes, and you have to see that. And so right now we're not there in either side. So, it's going to get much worse, and it has to. The euro is going to go under 80 cents. The euro is really, really bad. And most of these countries are really in pretty bad shape. Most people don't realize the worst debtor in Europe is actually Britain. Right now, I think, honestly, I would look at, you know, the stock market will make a false decline. That would probably be the time to buy, and then it should, you know, blast off again. I mean, if it gets to the 23,000 level in the Dow, now we're into one of those bubble type things. But our resistance has been in this 18.5 to 18.7 area, and it's been crawling. This is not what you get with a high. And when it's a high, it's like a real bubble type thing. I mean, I was around for gold in 1980. I can tell you it went from $100 in 76 all the way up to the 400 area by December 79. And then it goes from 400 to 875.
Just like the NASDAQ, you know, circa 2000, 1999, 2000. I mean, you saw 200-300% increase in about a year. There's a zenith. There's a peak.
That's the bubble. You know, you see the same thing in 1989 in Tokyo. That's why I'm saying the stock market is not there. It's just not there.
But you know, one interesting parallel, though, you might notice that the NASDAQ, within earshot of that 5,100 or so peak, you know, that's what silver did in 2011. You know, it got back towards its peak, and then the whole house of cards imploded. Kind of raises some red flags. Now that the NASDAQ is back to its 15-year high, could we see something similar shaping up over the next year?
Oh, sure. I mean, you'll get a correction out of it, which will scare a lot of people.
The sentiment remains so amazingly bearish. Every time there's even the slightest little hint of a sell-off, and you don't see that. You see euphoria when you're really near the peak. When you're near the top, you can't scare the herd away. Every sell-off is where they're buying. The Jesse Livermores are selling.
I was giving a seminar in Tokyo, and it was just really for institutions, and this individual bribed his way through the hotel to get in. And he comes up to me and says, I apologize. I just really had to talk to you. He bought $50 million of the Japanese stock market the day of the high. Now, that was, all right, fine. You know, I figure real speculator. But what made it more interesting, he was in his 60s. It was the first time he ever bought stock. And I met the guy that bought the legendary high. So I asked him, I said, what made you buy this on that day? And he said for 7 years, brokers had called him. Every January, the Nikkei went up 5%. For 7 years, he watched it. He goes, okay, they're right. He bought it the end of December 1989, just expecting to make 5%, and here it's down like 30-40%, and he still had the same thing.
I mean, if you recognize you're in a bull market like the equities have been, you can actually buy the dips and not get nailed by those false breakouts that kill everybody, or like you had in gold and silver for 12 years. You could buy those pullbacks, so don't be the $50 million guy. The final trade at the top of the market.
Yeah, don't buy the spike highs. I mean, you can buy a breakout of like the old high or something like that. But, you know, if this thing is like, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40% above the old high, be careful.
Do you have any kind of target or forecast for the Dow Jones?
Our medium range target is probably in the 23,000 area. There is a possibility that if we exceed that and we see the capital flows really pour into the United States, then you're going to get a bubble here, like 29.89 in Tokyo. And then the high would probably come in around 17, and then you're looking at anywhere from like 35 to 40.
The money will really be made on the downside when that thing breaks. I mean, there's going to be more Livermores making fortunes.
Well, you also have to ask yourself this question. If the amount of money in bonds is basically 10 times that of equity, and people get scared of bonds because it's government that's the one that's in trouble, where do you go? You know, and the only thing is private assets, and that's, you're seeing it in real estate, you're seeing, you know, who's buying the real estate? The Chinese have been buying all the biggest high-priced tickets. The Canadians have bought more real estate in the United States as far as numbers are concerned. That title belongs to Canada. If you're looking at New York, Florida, et cetera, the Europeans have been buying everything.
Do you see real estate peaking, though, along with the equities market? I mean, they tend to move pretty much lockstep, don't they?
It depends. The speculative side did peak out in 1927. That was the Florida land bubble. And then the stock market did continue higher for 2 years after. So they don't always peak together. It depends if it's a real speculative bubble or what. But right now we have a lot of money coming into the main centers area. So California, you see a lot. New York City. You're not seeing it in the house in the suburb type thing. That would be domestic. So the foreign money that comes in, they want the high-flying stuff.
So you'd still be a buyer here for the typical family home?
Well, if you're going to do real estate like that, I think, you know, honestly, we're heading towards more of an ice age rather than global warming. But this energy output of the sun also has a cycle to it, which they tend to ignore. So each winter should be getting colder and colder. And so I would be looking at going south rather than north. But I would recommend that you try to basically hedge it, and you hedge it with a mortgage as far as you possibly can, but fixed. Not floating, definitely not floating. And because that way, if anything ever happens, all right, fine, you get back into a real, you know, difficult, you can walk away.
There are some interesting cycles here that show many ice ages do and have occurred. We saw them during, you know, the Dark Ages and the bubonic plague. It coincided with a mini ice age. What do you see here as far as you talk about maybe a lowering of the solar wind?
Actually, the energy output of the sun is a thermodynamic system. So there happens to be about a 300-year cycle in it. It's a thermodynamic system, so it beats like your heart. It doesn't put out energy at the constant, you know, pace. The low of that was largely in the 1700s, and we've just simply gone into the peak. And I mean, you can see there, I mean, the Delaware River and you know, next to Philadelphia, where George Washington crossed, you can see pictures of him, and there's icebergs in it. I've never seen like that. this is the first time that, you know, we did put a picture on our blog. There were literally the sea froze up at Cape Cod, and the beach ended up, when the ice started breaking up, icebergs all over the beach. I mean, bigger, taller than people. So, unfortunately, the peak in the energy output of the sun has already taken place, and the cycle is already heading back down. And it probably, on the short-term cycles, it will most likely bottom around 2020 or so. So it looks like at least for the next 4 years, we're going to get colder and colder winters.
You would certainly expect commodities prices, you know, as demand increases and supply wanes with the colder and colder temperatures, you lose your growing season. That could be an interesting opportunity for folks.
Yes, I mean, a lot of commodities in various different areas should start to go up when, you know, as the business cycle turns down.
Martin Armstrong, I wonder if you wouldn't mind telling folks more about the blog that you have there, all the services you provide, and any other contact information.
I would say you go to our blog. It's armstrongeconomics.com. We basically are institutional, and we do service the retail community as well. But we're pretty much everywhere. So we've got operations in Europe. We have Russian sites up in Russia and Asia. So we're probably one of the largest international firms.
Well, there's a lot to digest and plenty to keep you interested, engaged, and entertained at this website. So I hope everybody will click the links we're going to have online to Martin Armstrong's websites. Thank you for taking time. We're going to look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com radio.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. It was reported this week that confidence among U.S. homebuyers dropped to an 8-month low. A Bloomberg survey was expecting a gain in the sentiment gauge issued by the National Association of Homebuyers and Wells Fargo from 55 to 56. Instead, that sentiment gauge dropped from 55 to 53. Part of that resulted from the fact that sales of single-family homes declined to a 5-month low, and builder optimism about the industry outlook failed to improve. But there are mixed messages appearing throughout the housing industry. I spoke with a trusted friend in Florida yesterday who told me there are areas of that state's real estate market that are booming. Foreclosures are still rampant, but baby boomer relocations continue, and prices move forward. Florida may do well this time around as more boomers retire and more people try to escape northeast weather trends. Then I just read an article on drhousingbubble.com about the return of risky loans, the kind that helped augment the 2008 and 2009 collapse. One in particular by Freddie Mac, where they are now offering a 3% down payment loan that is called the Home Possible Advantage. There is also a resurgence of FHA loans and interest-only loans. Does anyone not see a repeat of recent history coming back? With a 3% down payment, if you need to sell your house, you're already underwater, with the average real estate commission being at 5 to 6%. But I guess everyone believes home prices are going to continue to go up once again. Then I heard Eric Sprott discuss in a recent interview that the next economic collapse will be worse than 2001 and 2003. Worse than 2007 to 2009. He believes if you take central planners, the Janet Yellens and government programs out of the market, it will become a no-bid market. A frightening but very plausible scenario. Because without a buyer of last resort, there is no last resort. And people who never imagined they would may start to resort to a much different way of life, including a much lower standard of living. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.